If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And when we think about gardening and landscaping, we often think about the food we want to produce and the beauty we want to create. But gardening and landscaping is also a great way to grow habitat for pollinators and other wildlife. A little later this hour, horticulturist Cindy Haynes and forester Mark Vitosh will be here to answer your questions about plants and trees. But we're going to start the hour with a conversation about creating habitat for birds. Adam Jenke is Assistant Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University and ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist. Adam, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And of course, when we plant things in our landscape, we are usually creating some kind of habitat for at least for insects, but often for wildlife. But we're going to talk about being a little more intentional about that than we usually are. So when you're thinking about habitat in your yard and thinking about whether you have it or don't have it, what are some of the elements we should be considering?
Yes. So this is something that I really enjoy talking and teaching about. It's something I talk about in any audience I get. We say there's three elements to wildlife habitat. They're the same three elements that we all need to survive: food, water, and shelter. And then we also consider in wildlife habitat that there's a fourth consideration. We call that space, which is just like a consideration for how food, water, and shelter are arranged. So we always like to remind folks, if all the food were in Boone County and all the shelter were in Story County and all the water was in Polk County, the only place we'd find suitable habitat would be right at the corner of all those. So we want to think about each of those elements and then how they're also arranged in our landscapes or in our neighborhoods or on our farms to make sure that we have the right habitat for the types of wildlife species we're interested in attracting.
And when we talk about food, we're not necessarily just talking about, say, bird feeders. We're talking about the things that birds naturally eat, right?
Sure. Yeah. In a combination of those, I mean, feeders are part of a way to attract a diversity of birds or animals to the yard. But yeah, we tend to think about providing the foods that the animals are naturally inclined to look for. And, you know, everything eats something in nature. So, you do kind of have to pick what types of animals you're looking for. But we can make some generalizations. And insects, you mentioned that already. Insects are really important food sources and something we should definitely keep in mind. One thing that we think about a lot of times with food is just planting natural food sources for birds. And the best example of that is things that produce like fleshy fruits. One that comes to my mind that's a really neat native shrub, very pretty, and provides good food is dogwoods. We have a bunch of different native species of dogwoods, like gray dogwood or red osier dogwood or alternate leaf or pagoda dogwood. And each of those could find, you know, a use in the yard that would also, every year, late in the summer, produce a berry that would be really sought after by birds that maybe grew up here in Iowa, or just as likely birds that are migrating through Iowa on their way to South American wintering areas that rely on fruits for their food source.
Well, and I think about some of the things that people plant where they call into the show and say, I fight the birds for this every year. Those are great habitat plants,
exactly.
Like serviceberry, for example. I know a lot of people would love to harvest their serviceberry, but sometimes it gets harvested a little faster by the birds.
That's right. Yeah, that's always good. When you notice the birds beating you to the harvest, that means that it's certainly a preferred food, and serviceberry is a great example. I mean, serviceberry has a lot of good things going for it. It has a beautiful flower. It's a native tree, small tree or shrub. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, it can be both food for humans if you beat the birds to it, and it can be really good food for birds as well.
What are some other things we can plant that would provide a good source of food for birds?
Yeah, so the next thing, so some birds will take advantage of nectar, though not very many. Baltimore orioles and, of course, hummingbirds will take advantage of nectar. So flowering plants are important, but flowering plants can be really important for insects that would feed birds. And so that's sort of the next level of thinking about landscaping for wildlife, is to think one level removed, what would be good for insects in our landscape that would then be good for birds to raise their young. And so what we say of many native birds, especially birds that nest here in Iowa, is that they grow on the backs of caterpillars. And so you'll see, you know, mothers and of birds providing food to their young in nests, and very often that's caterpillars. They're just really energy rich or protein rich sources of food for young growing bodies of young birds. And so we want to find ways to grow caterpillars on our in our landscapes, and the way to do that is to provide the appropriate host plants for those caterpillars. And so everybody knows about the monarch butterfly. It's a great example of what we call an obligate host, and that's a butterfly that has that lays its eggs and its larvae grow on one specific plant. And we all, of course, know in Iowa that that's the milkweed, because that's a really important conservation challenge we have. But there's over 1,500 other species of butterflies and moths that are found in Iowa that have that caterpillar phase and are really important food sources for a bunch of different birds. And so we can think about picking plants to put in our landscape that are going to be the host plants for a diversity of caterpillars. And there was this really neat paper that just came out this year, late last year, in Nature Communications, a really high-profile journal, where the researchers just basically summed up how many different species of butterflies and moths took advantage of certain woody plant genuses, so families or groups of woody plants. And they found there were a few species that were carrying the vast majority of weight for butterfly and moth larvae throughout the country. But in Illinois, for example, one of their study areas, they found that there were 1,600 species of Lepidoptera found in that study area, and 450 of those species could use oak trees as their larval host. Around 350 could take advantage of cherries and plums, and around 300 could take advantage of willows. And then there's this long tail of a distribution of all the other woody plants that we could put in our landscape. And of course, each of them could be important for certain species of those butterflies and moths. But if we want to think about just maximizing caterpillar production so as to maximize food production for baby birds, then we'd want to think about planting some of those really important genuses of woody plants, like those in the oak family or the cherry or plum family.
For seed-eating birds, what are some of the things that we might want to think about planting?
Yeah, so many birds take advantage of seeds, and so flowering plants of a diversity of stripes, you know, things found in our native tallgrass prairie that may be good nectar resources when they're in bloom can become good seed sources when they're not. The biggest thing I think to think about for birds and seeds is that much of that consumption is occurring among overwintering or fall migrating birds. And so sometimes we grow these beautiful flowers in our landscape and they bloom. And then as soon as they die, we cut them back and we take that wonderful seed resource out of our garden and we stick it in a bag and off to the landfill or compost bin it goes. And we like to encourage people to leave those kind of things, to not, what we, you know, gardeners will call deadheading, not cut that stuff out after it's bloomed, because we remember that the life of that plant has more to go. It could sustain more life by providing a seed source. So that's a strategy I use in my own yard, is I leave all my flowering plants, native flowering plants from last year that fed the the pollinators, when they were in bloom, I leave them all until early spring, and then whatever the birds didn't clean up over the winter time, I'll cut out, throw it in the compost bin, and let that stuff grow back again this summer.
Now, I don't want to spend much time on water because we haven't talked about shelter yet, and that's a pretty important component. And water can be pretty simple for birds. Just a bird bath can make such a difference, but of course, any kind of water feature. But let's talk about shelter. What do you mean beyond birdhouses when you say shelter?
Yeah, so shelter could be lots of things. It could be a place to put a nest. It could be, or importantly, thinking about the season we just survived, it could be a place to escape extreme temperatures or escape the eye of a predator. And so we think about shelter, you know, many different species of birds have different types of shelter they need. But I like to think of, you know, two main categories for nesting would be like places to place a nest. And so if you look at certain shrubs and small trees found in landscapes, look for places where there's horizontal branching, where a bird may be able to perch its nest. Of course, not all birds perch their nest, but many do. In trees like hawthorns that have, you know, complex horizontal branching can be a really good tree to have in the landscape to provide, say, a northern cardinal or an American robin a place to build a nest. Another really common place for, I was going to mention cavities too. Another really common one. So that's, you mentioned nest boxes. And nest boxes are just our answer to cavities. And those come from dead limbs and dead trees where woodpeckers, and sometimes I guess living trees as well, where woodpeckers can dig out a hole and then they take advantage of it in 1 year. And then every subsequent year, other species of birds like black-capped chickadees or house wrens can take advantage of those cavities. We call them secondary cavity nesters, and those can be really important habitats or shelter to have in our yards that we can also sometimes mimic with a birdhouse.
Well, we need to take a short break. We will be back in just a few minutes. And Adam, we can talk a little bit more about birds, but of course, people can call and ask you questions. We don't often have our wildlife specialist on the air. So if you've got questions for Adam, you can join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Of course, Cindy Haynes and Mark Vitosh will also be joining us in just a moment to answer your plant and tree questions. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We've been talking about landscaping and gardening for bird habitat with Adam Janke, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. You're welcome to call with your questions for Adam. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We also have Cindy Haynes joining us, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning, Charity and Adam and Mark.
Thank you so much for being here. And Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester, also on the line. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, all.
Well, thank you for being here. And Adam, before we wrap up our conversation about birds, you had mentioned when talking about insects that, of course, when you have insects, you are also attracting the predators that feed on insects, birds in this case. When you attract a lot of songbirds, you may also attract predators that feed on those birds. And we often get calls on the show, people saying, you know, I've got a Cooper's hawk that keeps picking off the birds at my feeder, and I don't want that to happen. Part of that is just the circle of life, right?
It sure is. And I'm smiling ear to ear right now because I get this question often, and I have maybe to some, it could come across as a cold attitude about it, but I just always say, well, you're just feeding a different kind of bird in that scenario. You know, of course, a Cooper's hawk or sharp-shinned hawks that spend their winters with us sure have figured out how to take advantage of bird feeders as a place where birds congregate. And Cooper's hawks and sharp-shinned hawks are bird specialists. They're uniquely adapted to be able to have swift flight that they can capture and prey on birds as their primary food source. And so As a wildlife biologist, I just admire nature. And so I just think it's the coolest thing ever when a Cooper's hawk takes advantage of my bird feeders. But to some, they don't like that. And you could have a good defensive strategy to minimize that. You could make sure your feeders are always close to woody vegetation, so those birds have a place to quickly escape to instead of having them out in the wide open. But I think the best way to deal with that is just to admire nature for all of its beauty and complexity.
And our first caller today has a question for you, Adam. Carol is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I am 72, saw my first two bluebirds, and it was when we had the sub-zero weather all day, and they were eating at my neighbor's ornamental cherry tree. What can I put in my landscape to attract more bluebirds?
Great. Well, that's a great question. And bluebirds are interesting. They're a yard bird for some people, and for others, they aren't. And that has everything to do with the bluebird really responding to sort of like landscape consideration. So bluebirds are like a classic oak savanna type open country or parkland type bird. And so you must, if you're seeing bluebirds in your yard, live in a relatively open neighborhood, not a very wooded one. And so that would be a good starting place. And then bluebirds, of course, like these other suite of birds, like to take advantage of insect prey, and particularly caterpillars. In fact, they're kind of our classic example of a caterpillar feeder for their young. And so having native woody plants that host a dense abundance of caterpillars every year could be a really good way to make sure those young are fed. And then the other thing with bluebirds is they are that secondary cavity user. So they're looking for abandoned woodpecker homes. And sometimes those are hard to find. And that's why we see so much use and success with bluebird box programs, because cavities can be the limiting factor for having bluebirds in an otherwise hospitable landscape or otherwise suitable landscape. And so if you think maybe you don't have enough nesting spots for bluebirds, then I definitely encourage you to build a bunch. They actually like neighbors, as we say. So you could build a number of bluebird boxes and hopefully host more bluebirds in the yard and in your neighbor's yard.
Well, and how cool, Carol, that you finally got to see bluebirds. That's really wonderful. Thank you so much for your call. And let's switch gears and go to a tree question for you, Mark. This is from Steve. Is spreading oak wilt still a concern if an oak tree has been dead for 3 to 5 years?
That's a great question, and the answer is no. Generally, that tree will utilize or spread spores only in the first spring after they die. So if that tree's been dead for more than a year, that tree could turn out to be a great cavity tree, as Adam talked about. If it's not a risk where it's not going to fall on anything and it can stand there, it would be a great tree to leave.
All right. And I do need to ask, it has warmed up considerably. Is it too late to prune oak trees?
Well, according to our forest health specialist, he put out an article a couple weeks ago, and he said at the end of the second week of March, so that will be Sunday. So we're kind of sticking to that. If you haven't pruned yet, get it done this weekend.
All right. And it should be nice, well, relatively nice to get a little...
Before it snows.
Right. A little bit of pruning done. Maybe do it today. Can you take the afternoon off? All right. Here's a question for you, Cindy, from Dave in Cedar Falls. I have ferns along the north side of my house where I need to raise the ground level to improve drainage. How much new soil can I add on top of the ferns without preventing them from coming up?
You're not going to be able to do too much. Ferns, they can be a little bit deeper because they like it a little bit wetter. But I would say if you're going to raise it up more than a couple of inches, you're probably going to need to dig up those ferns and then kind of put this, you know, create a new bed so that it's still moist and well-drained and still gets that drainage, but no more than, say, 2 inches on top.
All right, and
I think that's probably the max.
He's also wondering what is the best time to add that soil.
Actually, now would be good before they start to come up. So they just have to go through a little bit of extra effort to come up now. So they might be a little bit delayed in coming up. It's also a good time right as they come up to, you know, dig them up, divide them, and lift them if needed. So if you could do this in early spring, maybe not this weekend, but in the next, say, month, you're probably in good shape.
All right, great. Let's go back to a bird question. Lori is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I have a couple questions about bluebirds. Again, like the other lady, when it was really cold and there was snow all over the ground, we had 5 bluebirds come to our suet feeder. And I was quite worried about them because I thought they were mostly insect eaters. So I went out and got some dried mealworms, and it took them a day or so to find them. But they have gone through 3 bags now, but they disappeared as soon as it got warm. So my question is, did they come early, and are there insects hatching, and that's why they're not around now?
Yeah, those are really good questions and also really neat observations, Lori. I actually suspect that maybe those birds that you were seeing in the bitter cold were migrants. So bluebirds are, they're pretty winter hardy. They don't move really long distances. And of course they do occasionally overwinter in Iowa, but their range extends all the way up into Canada. And so, and they're not that tough. Like they can't survive a Canadian winter. And so they would probably, many of these bluebirds would just kind of, that breed in further northern areas, probably just work their way down until they can't, to an area where they can find food and survive for the winter. And so I would say that those birds that you were seeing relatively regularly at your feeder have taken off, and they're off to their northern breeding grounds, and maybe new birds would show up and start using the feeder. And then, yes, I think you're right that they're probably starting to find more insects out associated with the warmer weather. And so they may not be as tied in to a feeder source. So both really good observations. I bet you'll have new bluebirds in the neighborhood and maybe they'll find their way to your mealworms as well.
Well, that's great. We lost a bunch of trees and now our backyard is more meadow-like. So that may be a factor as well. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay,
yeah,
thank
it definitely
you much.
Should be, and great.
Thanks a lot for your call, Lori. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And let's do another bird question here. Linda's on the line in Muscatine. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question. We put up a purple martin house last year. The sparrows really like it. Is there a good trick to keep them out of the house?
Yeah, that's a really common problem, Linda. We have house sparrows and European starlings that both have an affinity for cavities and are pretty, you know, they're exotic species and they're pretty good competitors with our native cavity nesters, including purple martins and bluebirds and others. There are some solutions available. I'm just trying to think of the things I've seen, like different shaped holes can sometimes discourage or encourage certain species of birds, including purple martins, or discouraging starlings and house sparrows. Another thing that I've seen is having chicken or hardware mesh around the outside of the hole. And I'm not sure exactly what it is about that change that allows for purple martins but discourages those competitors, but that might be something worth trying. And fortunately, there's a lot of educational resources and advocacy about purple martin houses online. And so a quick search for purple martin house, I'm trying to remember, there's a national society involved in purple martins. There's a really reputable source. I just can't think of it off the top of my head. But for purple martins, and you'll find recommendations for trying to discourage house sparrows and starlings. That would be worth experimenting with, because once they've found it, it will be a problem that sort of plagues the colony for a little while now.
All right. Is it purplemartin.org, the Purple Martin Conservation Association?
That would be it.
All right.
The one I was thinking of. Thank you.
You're welcome. Purplemartin.org, Linda. Good luck with that. Let's do another tree question here from Teresa in Iowa City. I have 3 large yews, approximately 6 feet tall by 8 feet in diameter. How much can I trim them back without killing them? I would have to be, I would like to have them be 4 feet tall and 4 feet in diameter. Is that possible? And is now the time to trim them? And I realize that that puts us in the shrubbery gray zone here. So, Mark, do you want to tackle that or should I ask Cindy?
Well, let's ask Cindy and I'll chime in too. But it is in that shrub zone because there is some critical pruning to these.
All right, Cindy, you're on deck.
That's okay. Yews are an evergreen, and sometimes when we think about evergreens, we don't want to prune them back too much because they may not regrow as vigorously as some other kind of deciduous things. So I would say, you know, taking them that far back may be a little bit troublesome. However, it's also a yew, and if they're fairly well established, they will probably come back. It just may take them a long time to do it. Now is a fine time to do some of that pruning as well. My guess is there might be some additional pruning that might need to happen again in the summer because that severe pruning that you might do to kind of cut it back is going to encourage a lot of really vigorous growth, which means more pruning later.
All right. Here's a genuine tree question. This one's from Roger. He says, I lost an ash tree in the derecho. What should I plant to replace it? I'm thinking a white or red oak flanked by two fast-growing poplars that can be cut down in the future.
So that's a great question. And as we always, this is a great opportunity. It depends on what the site will take, Roger. You really need to look at that site, look at your soil conditions, look at the available light, look at the drainage, and then start looking at different information out there. Iowa State has some great publications on selecting shade trees. Iowa DNR has one called Rethinking Maple. And really start looking at the list and find what's going to fit. But for oaks, I like white oak. I like red oak. Red oak is actually a really fast-growing oak. We often think of oak as not growing very fast. But red oak actually has a really good rate. It has a good fall color, but they're very large trees. So you really need to think about, is that something that's going to fit? Another oak that I like is chinquapin oak. As far as planting poplars, I mean, that's fine if he wants that kind of cover and he wants it quick. But if he puts those poplars on the east and west side of the oak, they will get big enough that they will actually shade and alter that. So you may want to look at maybe some smaller trees. We talked about service berry, maybe crab apples, something that would stay there longer and kind of fit with those, or even red buds, ironwood, which is hornbeam, and another one called, or I'm sorry, that's hop hornbeam, and then hornbeam. So the poplars, they're only going to last about 20 to 30 years, and then they kind of fall apart. So I like the oak, but I might stay away from the poplars.
All right. And I'm sure that you're getting a lot of questions. This is going to be really an incredible spring of replanting for so many people in Iowa. Have you been inundated with questions just like that one?
Yes. The last 6 months, I've spent 95%. I cover seven counties. I've spent 95% of my time in one county, and that's Lynn.
Yeah.
And there's just so much devastation, so much damage. There's a lot of damage in Cedar, Jones, and other counties to the east. Benton to the west. But yes, the thing I tell people is if you don't get it done this spring, it's okay. Especially with shade trees, we can plant in the fall, and it may even be next year. We're hearing, you know, nurseries running low already. Our state nursery has sold a lot of seedlings this year. So don't be in a panic. If it takes another year or two to get it done right, wait the time.
All right. And we should do another show about tree planting here coming up soon, Mark. So
actually, I think we're doing one in April, if you ask Cindy.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Fantastic. I know a lot of people have questions. Okay, let's try to squeeze in one more question here before we get to the break. This is one for you, Adam, from Kathy. I have a new home office with a window that faces north. I placed bird feeders and suet on a hanging pole in an area surrounded by houses, but no trees or shrubs. There was bird and squirrel activity in the fall, but nothing for months, and the feeders were full. What can I plant to attract birds and make them feel safe in this smaller space?
That's a really good question. And that's to go back to how we started at the top of the show, the whole food, water, and shelter. And you really do need multiple of those to make it most attractive. And so, anything that would provide, shrubby vegetation to kind of provide a little bit of shelter near those feeders would probably make them more attractive. I'm thinking maybe that's a question for Mark and Cindy as much as me, just for like what would grow well on the site and what would kind of promote that structure, early growth. But things that come to mind, like small trees or shrubs, like I mentioned earlier, hawthorns could be really good kind of quick cover. Crab apples could also be pretty good, relatively quick cover. If there was, a little patch for a native silphium or something, viburnum could be really neat as well.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with me, Adam Janke, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist, Cindy Haynes, horticulturist, and Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We've been talking about birds in addition to plants this hour. Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Adam Janke is here. We've been talking about bird habitat, and he can answer your questions. Cindy Haynes is Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. She's here to tackle your plant questions. And Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester, will take your tree questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Verlin is up next in Des Moines. Hi, Verlin.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a wren house on my front porch, and I have three fairly large rhododendrons down below it. And last spring, I noticed when the wrens showed up and started building, the rhododendrons then started blooming, and some bumblebees showed up. And it appeared that the bumblebees had burrowed up through the bottom of the wren house. And I thought, or it looked like, the wrens left for a while, and then later on they came back. So I went out there last fall and put some caulking in there where the holes were. But then when I cleaned it out this just the other day to get ready for the wrens again, I noticed that the bumblebees did not actually burrow clear through the bottom. They just kind of made tracks in the bottom of the pine board on the bottom. I'm wondering if I've interfered with this bird insect thing that you're talking about and should have left well enough alone.
Interesting. That's a really interesting story, Verlin. What you surely saw were cavity dwelling bees taking advantage of the perhaps decaying wood. I would say it's probably more of a negative interaction that was playing out. Like the wrens probably weren't crazy about the bees coming into their house. Now, not all those I'm not an entomologist, but not all those burrowing bees would, sting or anything like that, but just, sort of the harassment. So I would say that it probably wasn't a positive or mutualistic interaction, but I don't know that it necessarily would be a negative thing. I just suspect, maybe the decaying wood in the wren house is just attracting a little bit different wildlife, a little smaller wildlife without a backbone. Maybe the caulking strip or caulking technique might actually be a good idea. Those wren houses, different species require cleaning boxes or not cleaning out boxes. And in my experience, I think it's helpful to clean out a wren box year to year. So when you do check it, just get other things out of there. And those bees could have very well overwintered actually in that wood. So it's hard saying. I wouldn't say the wrens would have fed on the bees. That's just probably not what was going on there. So a little bit of interspecies competition probably is what we would describe that as.
Yeah, I kind of prefer the wrens, so I'll go with the caulking.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yep, a caulking or perhaps a newer box. Yep, great.
Thanks a lot for your call, Verlin. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's a question for you, Cindy, from Judy. I have a jasmine plant that's been in the house all winter. Mm-hmm. It looks really healthy, but not blooming. Can I move it out on the deck when it warms up with hopes that it will flower this summer?
Yes, you can. And some jasmines do like the kind of shorter days of winter and then that transition into longer days to get them to blooming. So that may be what's happening. I would certainly wait to move it outside when it is, you know, going to stay above freezing. Jasmine generally is not super hardy and will not manage the snow this weekend. But you can take it outside on the warm, sunny days, bring it back in, and then it can go out in a more shaded location outside sometime in the middle or end of May.
All right. And here's a question for you, Mark, from Susan and Jewel. Do Japanese maples grow well in central Iowa?
I would suggest that we really struggle with Japanese maple. The further north you go, the more winter damage you're going to see. I would call it more of a southern Iowa, but even in southern Iowa and Iowa in general, when you have winters like this one, that's one species we get a lot of calls on that get winter damage, get killed back, and they really prefer a east to northeast exposure because they really don't like that sun either. So I would probably stay away from that.
All right.
Sometimes we suggest if you really have to have a Japanese maple, maybe planting it in a large container that you can have on your deck, and then it's something you bring into an unheated garage in the winter.
You have to really, really need a Japanese maple.
You have to really want a Japanese maple. It's a lot of extra work, but there are people who really want it. So
they're a beautiful
the extra
plant,
effort.
But they really struggle in Iowa.
All right.
They do.
Let's go back to the phones. Felix is on the line in Dysart. Hi, Felix.
Yes, good morning. And I'm just wondering about the effectiveness of elderberry as a shelter and a food source for birds. And also I'd be interested in knowing how good they are for pollinators.
All right, Adam?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a favorite of mine because it does check a bunch of boxes. It's food for birds, it's food for pollinators, it's shelter, and it also is food for people, if you like. Of course, people make elderberry jam and elderberry wine. And so, yes, elderberry is a really neat native shrub, and it has a just beautiful big white inflorescence that is very good for pollinating insects. And then it is also, those berries are definitely taken advantage of by birds. And so, yeah, it's a good one for sure. It's high on my list. It also grows in wet areas where I have a special affinity for anything that grows in wet areas. And so it's a favorite of mine for sure.
All right, great. Felix, thank you so much for your call. Mary is on the line in Iowa City with a tip for all of us. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share that in Iowa City, near the University of Iowa commuter lot, which borders also the miscanthus grass fields that are planted by the university, and this is also close to where the Ashton Cross Country Course is, there's just this tremendous show every night of starlings murmurating. And they, maybe your bird expert can share a little bit more about this, because I've watched and I've read a little bit about it, but don't really know a tremendous amount about it. But they start out, the birds fly in, and they roost in the trees, and they move where they roost. I've been watching since early last summer.
Yeah.
And so now if you get there like a little bit before 6 o'clock, the birds then descend after they murmurate, after they fly all around and do their incredible little show, then they descend into the miscanthus fields before they end up bedding down into the miscanthus fields. But I mean, there are somewhere, I'm guessing between 500,000 and probably 1 million birds that descend there. And it is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's like
Mary, thank you so much for that tip. I'm gonna just cut you off there. There are incredible flocks of starlings all over the state, so that's a great tip for that site. But I've been watching a lot of flocks of starlings. What are they doing, Adam?
Well, that's a really good question. So I thought Mary's description of the murmurations were really neat and vivid, and I agree. We see that with both red-winged blackbirds and then other flocks, large flocks of very gregarious birds going into roost. You know, I can't actually say what they have in mind when they're doing those large flights that to us appear very acrobatic. I guess I'm not exactly sure. It would depend on the time of year, what sort of the underlying behavioral motivation for that is. But what's unique among those species is their very gregarious nature, and that is that they just like to be in the company of, as Mary described, hundreds and thousands of their friends, and sometimes mixed species flocks as well. And so it is really neat. There's lots of, this time of year especially, lots of really cool, really big flocks to see, like big flocks of lesser snow geese migrating back to the Arctic are found all across Iowa, especially in western Iowa right now. And then red-headed blackbirds, grackles, and European starlings all have this very gregarious behavior that I think is just really, really neat to see big concentrations of animals like that.
So absolutely.
It's a cool story. Sounds like a neat sight.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, really fun to watch and try to photograph too. Just a
sure.
trick.
Yep.
All right. Davin is on the line in West Des Moines. And before I go to Davin, he's got a question about pear trees. And again, there's a gray zone there. So Cindy and Mark, who gets pear trees?
We'll give it to Cindy.
Okay. Davin, what's your question?
Yes, I have a couple Bradford pears in our backyard. And last year, they developed a fairly severe case of what I think is fire blight. And actually, several of the pear trees in my neighborhood had all showed signs of it. And I'm just wondering, what's the prognosis for them this year? Are they going to be salvageable, or do I need to look at taking them out and replacing them?
Right. So fire blight is a pretty serious disease, and it looks a lot like the tips of the branches have been burnt, hence the name fire blight. And there are pears that are very susceptible to this. Generally, in trying to control this, we try to prune out those tips, which is easier said than done, because we often have to go several inches away from where the blacken starts, because this is a bacterial issue. And then we have to dip our pruners in like a bleach, you know, a 10% bleach solution in between every cut, so that we're not transferring that bacteria from one cut to another. So that's a lot of work. And if you have just a little bit, it could be something that could be controlled. But if it's a lot, and it's going to impact a great deal of this particular tree, then maybe it is time to consider planting something else. And Mark, you've seen this one as well on Bradford pears.
I would agree 100%. And it's what I would probably do, if you could try to, if you can, you can often see those black lesions even now. You can actually tell the tissue, and you could try to cut major stuff. But once you do that, let it leaf out in the spring and kind of see what you have left. And it really varies from year to year. I mean, some years we really see it bad. If we have good moist springs with good humidity, it seems to, especially about the time that the blooms come out, because the bees and stuff and flies actually can spread that bacteria from bloom to bloom and plant to plant. And if there's a lot of activity, you tend to see, if the conditions are right, a lot of spread. So it also even gets on crab apples, usually not as bad, but a number of the pears. But I would agree with you, Cindy, that maybe do what pruning you can, reevaluate it this summer, and really see how much you have left. But from the spring and stuff like that, for ornamentals, I really don't see that justified. Pruning is about your only thing you can do to try to slow it down, and then kind of see what you have left.
And then I would also, suggest that this is your opportunity, you know, to look down the future in 5 years and maybe consider something else to be planted in that place, because in the next 5 years you will have a really bad year, and you'll consider removing the tree.
All right.
Sorry.
You can see the future, and it doesn't look great.
There.
Right. All right. Yeah. Let's hit another tree pruning question here. You already told us that if we're going to prune our oaks, we should get that done this weekend, today or tomorrow. And James wants to know if he needs to be concerned about sycamore pruning.
Well, in general, this time of year, if you still have trees that you want to prune and they're not oaks over the next probably few weeks, you can. In general, the two times I kind of like to avoid pruning is in the spring when they really start to leaf out and kind of in the fall when they change color, and that's on the non-oaks. Another really great time to prune is kind of midsummer, once the first flush comes out and the trees slow down a little bit, probably around June. There's been some research that shows that you actually get better wound response if you do it kind of in the middle of the summer. Now, again, we don't do that on oaks, but on other species. So if he needs to do some pruning in the next week or two before things really start to green up, go ahead. If he can wait, do some midsummer, he can do it then too. So he kind of has a number of opportunities with something like sycamore.
All right, let's try to squeeze in one more question here. Bobby's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. I have a question about planting a tree in my front yard. We lost an apple, crab apple, and a magnolia. And it's in the north side of my house where there's probably maybe 4 hours of sun at the most. And we've thought about a basswood or a tulip tree. Would either of those that condition?
The basswood would take the light. If you want a smaller tree, though, I would look at serviceberry, maybe redbud. I also mentioned medium-sized tree hornbeam and hop hornbeam. The thing with basswood, a lot of Japanese beetle, especially in the Iowa City area, so you're going to have problems. The tulip really likes more full sun.
All right. Bobby, thanks a lot for your call. And Kate is on the line. We don't have time to take her call, but she says, I'm getting 25 serviceberry trees from the DNR. What kind of prep does the soil need? Mark?
Basically, she wants just to get the soil worked up a little bit so she can get them to what they call the root collar, basically where the stem meets the roots. She wants to make sure that the soil or that the roots don't get L-rooted or J-rooted, that she gets it planted right at the root collar. But just kind of working that soil up a little bit so it's kind of soft when she gets it in there, and then just pack it in gently.
All right. Mark Vitosh, thank you so much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. Cindy Haynes, thank you.
Thanks, Charity.
Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And Adam Janke, thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Adam Janke, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Since we've been talking about plants, I want to put in a plug for our March Talk of Iowa Book Club. We're reading The Overstory by Richard Powers, which is all about trees and our relationship with trees. That On the Air Book Club is coming up on March 23rd. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.